I'm Pamela Wilson. You're with me on Talk Radio 630 KHOW. In our next hour, Dr. Cynthia Geppert, Associate Professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine, talks about ethical considerations when caring for a loved one, situations that most of us hope we'll never have to experience. Up next, Dr. Kirsty Dyer, a physician and an expert in life challenges, loss, grief, and bereavement, including traumatic losses. How many of you have experienced a situation where you felt a medical or service provider didn't understand your needs or wasn't as sensitive as you expected? Dr. Kirsty Dyer is a physician, health educator, professor, online instructor, lecturer, and author. She's an expert in life challenges, loss, grief, and bereavement, including traumatic losses. Dr. Dyer received her medical and master's degrees from the University of California, Davis. She's a fellow in thanatology, death, dying, and bereavement from the Association for Death and Counseling. Dr. Dyer, good morning and welcome.
Good morning.
The older adults and caregivers that we work with so often see physicians. They receive a diagnosis, and then they have very little understanding of what's needed from day-to-day coping and planning. When you were in school, what was training like around this subject?
There really wasn't a whole lot. You know, my background, I was trained in internal medicine, and we were taught to, you know, we were sort of focusing on the diseases and not really thinking about how those diseases impact the people once they get home.
And, I mean, it's, for our clients, it's problematic, but I know that that's not what physicians are taught. And I read, you wrote a paper, it's called Caring for the Person, Not Just the Patient in End-of-Life Care. Why do you believe that consumers see the medical profession as lifesavers?
Wow. Well, maybe it's because of all of the innovations. You know, the average lifespan at the turn of the century was 47. And now, you know, we have many people that are living to be over 100. And a lot of that is because of all of the technology, you know, the antibiotics, the various different procedures, the surgeon skills, the understanding of medical and disease processes that have happened, you know, within the last century or so. And that probably because of that, you know, the physicians have been looked upon as being lifesavers because they're the supposedly have been the keepers of the knowledge.
In your article, you shared an example from your personal life about what's called physician objectivity and distancing. Can you talk a little bit about that and then maybe talk about why medical schools kind of see, you know, when somebody's dying and they can't do anything else, they just kind of back off?
Well, I think that the article that I wrote was actually about my sister's father-in-law, and he was diagnosed with stage 3 esophageal cancer and went off to one of the, you know, tertiary care facilities. The surgeons came in and waved their hands and said, "Oh yes, we're going to be able to cure you." You know, and stage four anything, you know, usually isn't curative. And so I don't know how much of the problem and the distancing of his case was because he was on a surgical service. I do know that the hospital where he's at, they've done in the last, let's see, it's been 15 years since it happened, and there's been more of a move towards having teams and a more integrative approach to team services. Unfortunately, for some reason, the surgeons seem to be the last ones to get on board, and I actually did a surgical intern year in the midst of all, before I finished up my internal medicine residency, so kind of have a little bit of the insight to the surgery world, too. And so I don't know, you know, if it's just a particular thing. There are lots of issues, I mean, you know, with reimbursement for hospice and people not necessarily wanting to be labeled, you know, for hospice treatment, because then that means that they can't do other things. Fortunately, within this time span, there's also come up palliative care, which I think that's puts you in a different category, and it allows you to still get treatment even without having the terminal diagnosis.
Is, for me, being a physician, and I'm obviously not one, but I would think it would be so emotional because you see so many patients every year and you have to give them bad news. Is there, how do you balance the you know, giving the news and then hand-holding and kind of listening?
Well, I think, you know, that it's everybody does it a little differently. And I think that a lot of the people who end up going into particularly oncology or hospice sort of have a special calling for that field. I mean, you know, most of the people who really can't do the hand-holding choose other specialties. And I think that it's really, you know, it is still tough to try and do the balancing. There has been some changes in the way things are doing. Rachel Naomi Remen's program, what is the Art of the Healer, they're going in, UCSF started the program, and that they're going in and they're teaching medical students more about, you know, balancing and, you know, kind of taking care of yourself and, you know, perhaps giving people more permission, you know, to cry when a patient dies. I mean, I was chastised when I was a third-year medical student and my first patient died.
And you cried?
Yes, yes. Oh. And I, you know, it was AIDS patient. That death was unexpected, at least it was unexpected to me. And my attending just sort of, you know, kind of like, you know, you better get a grip, you know, girl, because, you know,
you're not going to make it.
Yeah, you've got a long road ahead, you know. Well, fortunately, you know, I ended up, I still managed to escape medical school with my heart intact. But probably because of so many of those experiences, I stepped out of clinical practice and I've been teaching the last 7 years.
What's your opinion on this? A lot of families, and mine included, my brother had leukemia. And, you know, the physicians on the other side kept saying, oh, there's this treatment and there's that treatment and there's this treatment. And I kind of felt that they wanted to keep offering him options, but they didn't really want to tell him that it wasn't going to work. Is there a balance between, you know, how do doctors know when that point is that they should say, you know, you've got treatment, but it's probably not going to be successful. Do you really want to continue this?
I think that really depends a lot on the physicians, and you know that many people go in and they want to be the fixers, and so even you end up having people going into oncology who want to fix things, and they went into oncology to be able to cure cancer. They didn't necessarily go into oncology to help people make good transitions at the end of life. You know, those are the people that end up going into into hospice. Unfortunately, the cancer docs aren't always talking to the hospice docs, and that a lot of hospice programs and palliative care programs complain that they just don't get the patients soon enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, you know, I guess people who want to help with end-of-life care go into hospice. People who want to cure cancer go into oncology.
So there's kind of a tug and pull there.
It's a bit, yeah. And you know, I think that unfortunately, it doesn't really sound, you know, that there's still a lot of that, you know, that the oncologist, you know, and they're coming out with the latest, greatest, you know, best drugs. And, you know, I guess if you keep waving things at people, you know, maybe you never have to tell them that, you know, that things aren't going to work.
So you're a physician, you're an educator, you've got so much experience. What have you learned about treatments at end of life for patients and just kind of the hand-holding, the giving people information to get by day to day?
Oh, wow. As far as getting by, I ended up, I guess, because of my frustration with the system, I put together our website, which is Journey of Hearts, years ago. Unfortunately, it was never funded, so it, you know, that the information is still there. It's not, you know, updated with all the latest, greatest flash plugins. But a lot of just, you know, dealing with end-of-life care, at least from, you know, from the physician's perspective, is trying to just sort of be present with people. And then other than that, it's just trying to sort of deal with, you know, the basic, you know, encouraging people to deal with the basic day-to-day needs, you know, making sure that they're getting plenty of sleep, making sure that they're eating healthy, you know, making sure that they're getting out and getting exercise, you know, working on stress reduction, try to find things that make them, you know, happy, you know, projects and being around people and that kind of stuff.
Is it also, though, a physician giving somebody permission to ask questions and kind of helping them figure out what questions to ask?
I think a lot of that's going to depend on, you know, who they're trying to ask the question to. That's one of the, I guess, disadvantages of being the female physician is that the patients always figured that you were going to be able to answer all the questions that everybody else never had been able to answer for them in the same amount of time that everybody else was being given. So I know that my girlfriends, who are also internal medicine physicians, you know, all of us would constantly be running late because we'd be answering more and more and more and more questions, unfortunately, in less and less and less and less time. So I think this is where, you know, a lot of the programs are getting, you know, additional people, you know, the nurses coming in, the
social,
you know,
workers,
health educators, the social workers, you know, even though it may have been some of the things that I was best at, you know, and I've been had been accused of, you know, should have been a nurse, should have been a social worker, you know, should have been a clergy person, that with the constraints of the system, you really weren't given the time to be able to spend with people.
That makes sense. Dr. Dyer, I thank you so much for joining us today. You've been fabulous.
Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I'm Pamela Wilson. You're with me on Talk Radio 630 KHOW. This is The Caring Generation, navigating life's transitions with dignity, clarity, and stability. Whether you're a caregiver or a person needing care facing an unexpected situation, or if you're interested in education to help you live a healthier and more informed life, you're in the right place with The Caring Generation every Sunday from 10 to noon. In our next hour, Dr. Nancy Berlinger, researcher at the Hastings Center, joins us to talk about the challenges that advances in medicine pose. We're living long, longer, but not necessarily healthier. Up next, how poor caregiving and health literacy, meaning the ability to obtain, understand, and use information, results in serious issues, especially for older adults and overwhelmed caregivers.